Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on this Monday morning here in the city as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I am Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us once again. We're going to do an interesting program for you today. We're going to touch on several various areas of the arts going on here in town. In the opening segment, we're going to talk to some friends of ours from the Lyric Opera of Kansas City, where they are doing The Barber of Seville, opening on April the 28th and running through May the 6th at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts here in Kansas City. Then later on in the program, we're going to talk about the UMKC Theater production of Freedom Summer, back to 1968, and one of the co-authors and director, Ricardo Kahn, will be with us to talk about that. But first, the opera. Yes, sir. Add some legitimacy to the program here today. The Barber of Seville, as I said, opens. Two of the singers are with us to help us understand and tell us all about it. Jarrett Ott is with us. He sings the role of Figaro. Figaro is the Barber of Seville. Jarrett has been in lots of places to sing. He has been with the Dayton Opera, Opera Philadelphia, New Orleans, Santa Fe.
The Deutsche Oper Berlin, yes.
Sounds like it would be an interesting place to work. Glimmerglass Festival, North Carolina Opera, Memphis, Seattle Symphony, Columbus Symphony, just a few among many. Is there any you'd like to add that I haven't mentioned,
Jarrett? No, I think you got a good amount of them. Yeah, thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. Jack Swanson is with us as well. He sings the role of the Count. He has done this role before at the Glyndebourne
Festival.
See, I knew I wouldn't get it right. I told him before we began the show that I wanted him to say it, and then I said it. L.A. Opera, the Santa Fe Opera, where a lot of good things are happening down there. The Winter Opera of St. Louis, Opera Memphis, Opera Delaware, Garsington Opera, Oregon Symphony, Norwegian Opera, and Portland Opera. Lots of places. You both travel?
A lot of traveling.
Do opera singers such as yourselves do a lot of transcontinental work? You both have credits for Europe, I noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a great amount of work in both the States and Germany, and especially Germany, and all throughout Europe. I myself am actually moving to Germany this September, so I'll be there for two seasons working in Stuttgart, Germany. So, yeah, I mean, there's quite a bit of work. I know Jack especially.
Yeah, this past 2017, actually half of my year was spent in the UK. I was with Garsington Opera near Oxford doing another Rossini opera, Il Turco in Italia. And then the Glyndebourne tour is what I did this past fall, which was Il Barbiere, where I sang the Count. And then a lot of work to be had in Europe, and we jump over the pond quite a bit. So.
Sometimes I ask the singers, now this particular opera is sung in Italian with English subtitles, and the way they do it at the Lyric, it's very easy to follow, by the way. We can touch on that later, but you have to be fluent in various languages. When you're in Germany, you're singing in German, so I assume you had to learn German in school?
Yeah. From day one, we are learning languages. First, we start with learning how they are spoken with the phonetic alphabet, and we learn how to write them out and learn the different sounds. And then we are taking courses on German, Italian, French, sometimes Russian and Czechoslovakian and Spanish. And, you know, the list goes on and on and on. Sometimes we don't get to really get into a language, such as, you know, a Czech opera, and you kind of learn, you translate, obviously, every single word, and then you kind of make meaning out of it. But, we study quite a bit with language.
Yeah, I was very fortunate when I was in my master's degree at Rice. They provided a 3 to 4 week class in Italy, in Florence, where we went, we had about 5 or 6 hours a day of total immersed Italian. And that's it just so happens that most of the repertoire that I sing is in Italian. So I have studied German and French, but I tend to sing a lot of Rossini and Bel Canto roles, so that was very helpful to me that just so happened the language that Rice chose for us to study.
Yeah, that would be Rice University in Houston.
Yep.
I know it's got to be difficult to hit it and get the same nuance that you would have if it were in English, but so many of the operas are in foreign languages. You're probably used to it by now.
Although I have done a Mandarin Chinese opera before at the Santa Fe Opera. We did that.
I was told that that's the hardest language to learn. So did you do it phonetically speaking?
It was totally phonetically. Yeah, I had never studied Mandarin Chinese before, but when we showed up, Jarrett was talking about how we use IPA, which is a bunch of symbols that show us what vowels to or what noises to make pretty much over the top of the language. And so when we showed up to Santa Fe, we had our scores all IPA'd, and it was a really, really difficult opera to do, but it ended up being amazing, and it had great success there.
Yeah, I hear a lot of good things about Santa Fe, both opera-wise, arts scene-wise.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's where Jack and I met originally. We were both young artists at the Santa Fe Opera back in 2015, I believe it was.
Yeah.
And now this upcoming summer, luckily we're meeting here in Kansas City, and then this upcoming summer we're both principal artists at the Santa Fe Opera. So, yeah, it's a wonderful place for the arts, as is Kansas City.
Favorite places around the world to sing.
Exactly. It's nice to reconnect with friends all around the world. That's one of the best part of this job, you know.
I hate to say most enjoyable, but you've sung many places around the world. Was there one that was more gratifying for you than any other places? I'm going to assume somewhere on the continent of Europe.
I mean, I really had a great time this past fall with the Glyndebourne tour because we got to go from theater to theater, and I really got to experience places in the UK that most people don't. When they go over, they typically go to London and maybe somewhere nearby, Canterbury, but when I was there, we went to Canterbury. We went to Plymouth, which is a place where you'd really have to be making a trip to go to Plymouth if you weren't asked to be there for something like this. And so I really got to see all the countryside, and it was really beautiful, and I had a great time there. So
if you don't, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I mean, some of my most memorable singing has actually happened here in the States, just, you know, working artistically. But then you get to go and do some of these tours like Jack did. I did another one for a Russian opera company, but it was all throughout Germany. And, you know, just getting those opportunities to see a part of the world that you wouldn't get to see, and, you know, get paid to travel around and create art, which is fantastic, and get to meet community members on these different
new
places.
New audiences,
and get to communicate and see these different cultures. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, that's a good point. You when you're here, you probably get to meet the board of the Lyric Opera and all the people involved.
Yeah.
But the same anywhere in the world.
A lot of barbecue. We go into a lot of barbecue here in Kansas. We're up for recommendations.
Either of you worked here before?
No, this is both of our debuts here.
Yeah, with the Lyric Opera.
Yeah, so they've taken you to barbecue places.
Well, we found some,
yeah.
Had a lot of recommendations.
Yeah, well, they are singing The Barber of Seville. It opens on Saturday, April the 28th at 7:30. Performances continue then Wednesday, May 2nd at 7:30, Friday, May 4th at 7:30, and closes out on Sunday, the 6th of May, with a 2 o'clock p.m. Afternoon show at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. The number to call for more information, 816-471-7344, or online at kcopera.org. It is The Barber of Seville. The Barber, in those days at least, the barbershop was kind of a community place. People went to not only get their hair cut, but to hear the latest gossip, to hear what's going on, what's coming up, any rumors that are going around. Is it the same with Figaro?
Absolutely. He from all this information that he gathers throughout the community, he thinks that he can do everything. He can be the veterinarian. He can be a gardener. He can help with any any problem that you may need, especially love, which this story very much revolves around. And he's just a fun, loving, goofy character that I think everybody can relate to, really. He goes for the gusto and sometimes fails, but then he kind of loves that failure at the same time because it gives him a new outlet to find something, a new problem to create. And it's just such a fun, uplifting, hilarious opera. It's opera buffa, and which is, you know, just fun, outgoing, energetic, the whole entire time, especially in this production.
Yeah, and the count knows this about Figaro, and he's finally seen someone. Her name's Rosina, who he thinks is the most beautiful girl he's ever seen. And he knows that Figaro is kind of the guy to go to if you've got a problem where you really need to. The problem with the count and Rosina is that there's a man named Dr. Bartolo who she lives with, and he is technically her what would you say, her her supervisor, but he also has a thing for her, and the count has to find a way to kind of dupe him and knows that Figaro's the guy to go to get in there and get Rosina.
So you're kind of a matchmaker for people,
yeah,
in a way,
yeah,
exactly.
In a way.
Yeah, and I also create fires along the way. I'm telling him to be a soldier, to come in dressed as a soldier, to a
drunk soldier,
and then a drunk soldier. Yeah, I was going to try to leave that part out, but you know, they can. It's fun here, right? The next thing, I have him come in and try to be the music teacher, and all these ways to get Rosina for them to spend time together. It's a hoot.
Is there opposition other than her mentor for this?
Probably, but we don't see it in this story. He's enough of the pain to get through.
Yeah, exactly. Rosina's so beautiful in Oh Bella, and I think maybe even Figaro used to have something for her, but it didn't work out. So, you know, here, come on, Count. Come on in.
Yeah, I'm going to try.
Tell us about Rosina. Who is the performer who sings that role?
Cassandra Velasco, who is a fantastic mezzo-soprano, she is taking on this role. And, you know, in this particular production, you know, usually stylistically, she's the kind of standoffish and a little shy. Well, in this one, she is a dominant, strong woman, and she knows exactly what she wants, and she kind of plot twists quite a bit in this, and she's fantastic at it.
Which also brings up something you wanted to talk about, more of a modern version here. There are other traditional versions that you've done in other places. Would you both like to talk about that and tell us the difference?
Yeah, I've actually done the Barber of Seville. I did it in school, and then I did it on the Glyndebourne tour, and both of the productions that I've done were modern productions, and in one of them,
in what sense is it modern?
Modern, so actually set in like the 80s, 90s.
Okay.
The count, as opposed to being more of the dressed up actual count, a lot of the time we use him as like the first time I did it, I was a rock star.
I see.
In Glyndebourne, I was kind of a rock star as well. I wore a very bright silver jacket and had my hair all kind of spruced up, almost like an Elvis type hair. And it's interesting with Barbara Seville being one of the most popular operas still done today, and kind of in the top five of companies that it's always coming back and always being done. You have to find new ways to do it, or audience members go, "Oh, we've seen this a million times." And although we might laugh at the same jokes, and you can use a lot of the same jokes, it's nice to kind of have it spruced up and new costumes and new characters. Like Jarrett was saying, our Rosina in this show is a little bit more fiery than maybe a Rosina they've seen before, and it's up to the audience to decide which one they like more.
Well, sure, more of a modern woman.
Yeah, exactly.
And back
so
in
maybe
the day,
easier to relate to.
And it was originally set in what year? The original
The 19th century.
Mm-hmm. The 19th century. So, yes, she would have been considered a modern woman in her era.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But yes. not for this era.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I see what you mean now. Yeah. So they use elements of changing some things in the story, changing something, but not the basic story, folks. It's still the basic story.
Still the libretto.
I mean, Rossini, it's such a masterpiece, The Barber of Seville, that it can withstand time so seamlessly. And I think it works in many, many different situations. And this production, and you'll see it in the sets based off of Pedro Almodovar's films, beautiful colors, very vibrant. And I think it really ties in well with the Spanish influences, and because this is in Seville. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really pulls it all together. And it's really well done, this production.
We're speaking with Jared Ott and Jack Swanson, two of the performers in the Lyric Opera production of The Barber of Seville. Opens on Saturday, April the 28th at 7:30 p.m. Performances then continue Wednesday the 2nd at 7:30, Friday the 4th at 7:30, and Sunday afternoon matinee on the 6th of May at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. The number once again to call, 816-471-7344, or you could hop online at kcopera.org. As we speak with Jarrett and Jack, the modern version as opposed to the traditional version. I guess you've both done both versions. Mm-hmm. This is, I'm going to guess, more fun than the traditional version.
I mean, kind of depends on the director and their take. Okay. I think. I mean, I've actually haven't done the period one yet. I've actually only ever done modern.
Oh, and I see.
So I'm kind of looking forward to at some point just going back to the basics and finding the original count, and then, you know, he might walk differently, he might treat people differently as opposed to how a rock star might. He might be more standoffish.
I see.
It's that type of it really does, just putting him in a different era and in a different clothes and a different almost profession, if you want to say,
right,
can really change the way that he interacts with people on stage.
Sounds like a more Elton John type
version. Exactly. That's actually exactly what
I wonder if he's considered doing the role before.
I'd love to hear it.
Up to him, of course. Probably, he has a wonderful voice, maybe not the kind of voice to do this. You have special training along the way. Absolutely. Some of the people have told me that, well, I've heard various stories, but one that keeps coming around is, oh, as I grew up, I sang in my church choir. At one point, someone nudged me, took me aside, and said, you know, with the kind of voice you have the potential to sing opera. Have you ever considered that? And they usually say no, but somehow they get started in it. Is that sort of the way it happened for
actually,
both of you?
It's almost exactly my story. You know, I started in church choir, and then I was, you know, at that young age of middle school, I was embarrassed to join the choir, but then I had a wonderful music teacher that was just give it a shot, and I did. And I ended up excelling in this, and then I had a voice teacher later on in high school that said, you can get, you know, you can go to college. A college will pay you to go to school, you know. And that's exactly what happened later on in life. And my voice teacher in college brought me to my first opera at the Met. And it was The Barber of Seville. And I got to see Figaro come out. And ever since that moment, he comes out in this big wagon. And I was hooked ever since. And I never imagined, coming from a small town in Pennsylvania, that I would be on an operatic stage. I didn't even know what opera was, truly. And you know, over the course of time, you get to grow into that love for opera and understand its nuances and why we still create this awesome art form that it gets lost in translation, literally sometimes. And it's, you know, it's great coming from a small town to loving opera and seeing the world. You know?
Now, what's your story, Jack?
I was very fortunate that growing up in Minnesota, we had the choral tradition. And at my high school, the choir was just – it was actually considered to be a cool thing to be a part of in my high school. And so that was I played lacrosse for a while, actually, and I had a knee injury. And I kind of said, what am I going to do with my free time now? Because at that time I a lot of my time was spent doing sports after school, and I started taking choir more seriously. And my choir director said, "Why don't you actually, there was a solo in one of the Bon Williams pieces that we were doing that had a high A in it that I couldn't quite reach yet. And my choir director said, why don't you start studying with this guy that we're going to hire? And I said, okay. So I started taking voice lessons. We figured out how to sing that A, and I ended up doing it with the choir. And then he said, you know, you actually – you have a particular voice for opera and a particularly high voice to sing you know, a lot. He actually called it when I was 17 years old that I'd be doing a lot of Rossini and Bel Canto. And and then since then, I started auditioning for schools and kept studying voice, and now I'm singing opera.
I guess it's a particular kind of voice. The late Jim Nabors, who passed away recently. Mm-hmm. His speaking voice, as opposed to his singing voice, was entirely different.
Yeah,
was he doing differently when he would sing that way?
Well, to be honest, I actually get that a lot, too. I tend to speak – if you have anybody knows, Jared and I almost speak on the same level and the same pitches.
Exactly.
And it depends on person to person, but a lot of people will say when they meet me, oh, you must be a baritone. Or I'm just like, no, I just haven't sung yet today because I just get lined up, and I have particular exercises that get me more in that place. And then, it changes actually where I speak and the pitch that I speak on.
Is it more with the throat, the abdomen? It couldn't be the throat because you'd wear out real fast,
exactly.
I would think.
I mean, it really, it's about finding the right placement and then staying in that as you're singing. I mean, sometimes a lot of people will say using the mask, using kind of the front of your face and putting it up here and keeping it high and light. Otherwise, some people like to think kind of the sound coming out from the back of your head up and keeping your soft palate up. And once you find that in the day, you know, if I'm going to sing Rossini, I'll typically get in the practice room, do 20, 25 minutes of finding that place, and then I'm in it for the day.
Mm-hmm. And you have to have a strong voice. They don't mic the performers at the Kauffman Center. And I would assume that probably in most operas around the world, they don't mic either.
No.
The Kauffman's a bigger room probably than some, but there are probably some bigger ones.
I guess
the ones in Europe are mostly smaller rooms.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It actually... I think a lot of the theaters in the States require a voice that can carry, you know, sometimes up to, at the Met, it's 4,000 seats.
Wow.
It's a huge theater. And I'm not sure how many seats in the Lyric, but it is definitely a part of our training is to find the resonance to carry.
Yeah, I mean, from day one, we are taught to keep the sound forward, and in order to support, with the breath properly, in order to carry through all these people and, communicate through the text, too. And, you know, it all has to be done very meticulously. And we're taught to cut over a huge orchestra. And
the hard part is to keep it beautiful while doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, Jared and Jack will be here for the run of the Barber of Seville, but I'm sure they have plans. These people are booked probably years in advance. Where do you head from here?
Well, we both head to the Santa Fe Opera this summer for the summer, and
nice place to be.
Indeed it is. And then I'm off to Germany for the next two seasons, which means 18, 19, 19, 20. But next summer I'll be in New York City singing with the New York Philharmonic.
Get to fully immerse yourself in German culture.
Yeah, exactly. And then culture shock back to New York City.
Yeah, has to be very enjoyable to experience that. Most people don't get that long of a time to... I've traveled to the Middle East, but wasn't there long enough to really immerse yourself in the culture.
Yeah.
What about
John? So after this, I actually head to D.C. for a little bit. I'm doing a Rossini Stabat Mater there, some more Rossini. Then I head to Santa Fe, where I'm doing even more Rossini and L'Italiana in Algeri. And then I head to Norway, where I'm doing Donizetti's Elixir of Love. I'll be there for about 2.5-3 months. And then next season it's Palm Beach, and I come back to Barber Seville in Portland next May.
Do you tend to get cast in some of the same operas?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. Once you get become known for certain roles, companies will hire you to repeat those over and over again.
You probably like that. Well, there may be times when you'd want to do other things.
Yeah. You don't want to. I mean, you don't want to become pigeonholed into something.
But
I mean, some people do. Some people want to do their four or five things. And I actually want to, you know, do those and become and feel like, oh, I really feel like I've not mastered this character, but I've you know, found a lot of different ways to do it. I feel really comfortable with it. But I also want to explore new roles.
Of course. It is said that there are two kinds of operas, comedies and tragedies. Maybe some romances mixed in. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially we're living in such a great time because there's so much new opera being composed right now. Mm-hmm. Composers Jake Heggie, Jennifer Higdon, Missy Mazzoli, Libby Larson. I could go on and on and on. There is so much new opera being produced right now, and it is such a fantastic thing because, you know, they're talking about current events and current times, and the soundscapes are just fantastic that are coming out of these new innovative operas, and the directors are taking such great liberties with these, and it's a fun time to live in, you know. Mm-hmm. And I especially have been lucky to get to do some of these new works.
Do some of the companies, I don't expect you to name them, but do some of the companies want to stick with the traditional, or others more adventurous? I guess it depends on the boards of the operas, I guess.
It depends on the audience a lot of the time. You know, if they know that the audience wants new opera, then they're going to sell those tickets and a lot of the time it depends on who's in charge and things like that. But it's for some audiences, I think it's hard to convince them that new opera can be as important as the great stuff.
And it was a great one they had here a few seasons ago. It was the summit of Nixon going to China. I didn't really know what to expect, but it was just
great. I'll be doing that. Yeah, go ahead.
No, please.
I'll be doing that in Germany, actually. So it's a fantastic opera,
and they just did Everest this past season. Which
was fabulous.
Apparently was huge success here. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that convinces the audience that, we'd like more of this. And, you know, throw at least one in the season every year.
I don't expect that the traditional ones will ever die out. No. But it's nice to see that new ones are being composed all the time.
Yeah.
It's sung in Italian, The Barber of Seville, sung in Italian with English subtitles. And I want to mention this. You can see the words on the front of your seat.
Yeah, everything's right there.
If you need it.
Yeah, translation.
But they often in the programs have a very good explanation of what's happening. Some people say, well, that ruins the ending. But
I do recommend reading online or in the program when you get there, just a synopsis. It's so much easier to just follow along and enjoy the opera if you're not like, what is happening at this moment? Mm-hmm. Especially in Rossini, they tend to take one easy thing and drag it out for about 20 minutes repeating the same words.
Yes.
So
It's quite easy to follow. You'll be surprised.
Especially The Barber.
Show opens Saturday, the 28th of April. Performances continue then in May, Wednesday the 2nd, Friday the 4th, all at 7:30. Closes with a Sunday afternoon matinee on the 6th of May at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, the one that some people say looks like the Sydney Opera House. kcopera.org, and the number to call for more information. Lots of information on that website, by the way. And the number to call for more information, 816-471-7344. I want to thank my guests for being with me, giving us all the ins and outs on what's it like to be an opera singer, where you all go, what it's like to sing, and how you develop that voice that you need to do it. Jarrett Ott, who sings the role of Figaro, and Jack Swanson, who sings the role of the Count in The Barber of Seville, opening April 28th at the Lyric Opera of Kansas City. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Play Festival going on at UMKC and the show Freedom Summer, set in the turbulent year of 1964. Ricardo Kahn and Duncan McIntyre will be with us to talk about that when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM. And welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. We have so many events to cover. I'm going to try to get two interviews in one segment. That's not easy, but I'm going to do my best. First, we're going to talk to our friends over at City in Motion Dance Theater, where their company concert is coming up. It's called Homage, and Homage is what people who have made an imprint, who have left us, who are going to be leaving us, and all that goes into that. That is the theme of this year's presentation, correct?
Correct. Absolutely.
This is Tracy Jensen, by the way, the school director of City in Motion School of Dance.
Hello.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about the presentation of Homage.
Homage is done on 3 evenings, so it's going to be April 27th, 28th, and 29th. The 27th, the Friday night show, is we're doing something different this year. So our Friday night show is industry night, and our Saturday night show is our wine gala, where we'll do a huge fundraiser called the Wall of Wine, which is a really fun raffle to win a lot of wine. And then the Sunday matinee is a presentation of our apprentice company is going to open the show. So it's going to be every evening is going to be a really special homage.
Yes, Amanda January is with us. She is the Associate Co-Artistic Director of City in Motion.
That's right.
And
hello.
Tell us about Homage as far as artistically speaking. One of the co-artistic directors passed away during this past year. And another one is leaving.
Yes, Stephanie Whitler, our co-artistic director, will also be leaving. And we're bringing back a piece of Dale Fellens, who was a co-artistic director of City in Motion. It's called Anudu. And we just wanted to honor Dale and reset his piece.
Had he done that before, for instance?
Yes, we have.
At the choreographer showcase, perhaps? The one that's in February?
Yeah, I think it was presented at A Modern Night at the Folly. Absolutely. It's one of his signature pieces. So it is a really a wonderful piece to bring back. People are going to remember it. It's high energy, and it really represents the kind of choreographer that Dale was.
Yeah, that's very nice to do that for Dale. Now, Stephanie Whitler is retiring. She's much too young to retire. Why is she retiring?
She's been with the company for a very long time, and I think she feels that, you know, she's given, you know, many, many years as a co-artistic director and as a dancer, and, you know, is ready to just pass the torch and let City in Motion continue to be such a wonderful part of the dance fabric in Kansas City.
Yeah, well, that'd be nice for her as well. Now, let's get all this down in the time we have remaining. It's at the H&R Block space at Union Station.
Yes.
The city stage.
And it has been newly renovated, so it's going to be even better than it was before as a space to see dance up close.
Yeah, that's the same place where the Theater for Young America does its presentations during the day.
Correct.
More adult productions take over in the evening times. But that's where it's going to be. The 3 dates, the industry night she mentioned, Friday the 27th at 8 o'clock p.m., Saturday for the big wine thing that you talked about on the 28th, also at 8 o'clock p.m., and Sunday afternoon matinee with the Apprentice Company, I guess, starting things off on the 29th. That will be at 2 o'clock p.m. It's at the H&R Block, and go online to cityinmotion.org. Is there another website or a phone number that
Absolutely.
They can call
you
as well?
You can also find us on unionstation.org.
Was Amanda part of the putting this all together?
Yes.
Yes?
Okay. Tell us about your piece. Amanda's piece is going to be a really wonderful new work that is called Episodes, and it has perfectly placed popular music to tell a story about real life.
Okay.
And it's excellent.
Okay, well, we can look forward to that coming up on Friday, April 27th at 8, Saturday the 28th at 8, and Sunday afternoon on the 29th at 2 o'clock p.m. at the H&R Block stage at Union Station. Go online to cityinmotion.org. And is there a phone number that they could use as well?
Yes. 816-460-2020, and that will take you to the Union Station box office.
Thank you very much, ladies, for being with us. Tracy Jensen, the school director of City in Motion, and Amanda January, associate co-artistic director of City in Motion Dance Theater. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now we're going to turn our attentions to the UMKC Theater Department, the very prestigious UMKC Theater Department, where they are being part of the New Works Festival, KC Origins, I was told to say. And with us to tell us all about the show that one of my guests not only directs, he co-wrote. Ricardo Kahn is with us once again. He was with us a few years ago. Thank you for coming back.
It's good to be back.
And talking about another one of your plays. And he brought along with him Duncan McIntyre, who is also in the show. Duncan, let's do Duncan first. They both have pretty long bios, so I'm kind of stretching here.
We could just talk.
Duncan was in The Secret of Courage at the Coterie Theater, has appeared with the Kansas City Actors Theater, did Richard III with the Great River Shakespeare Festival, and he is part of the prestigious MFA acting program at UMKC. Only if you get in.
Yes, I'm one of the lucky few, I guess.
When Theodore Swets was with us, he talked one time how they take interviews from around the country for this program.
Yes, they do.
And you were fortunate to get in.
And here I am.
And here Ricardo Kahn is with us once again. He is a special fellow now. They keep changing your title.
That's okay. As long as I'm special, I'm good.
with UMKC. Mm-hmm. And Ricardo is directing, and he is the co-author of the show Freedom Summer, a show set in 1964 in Mississippi, Ricardo?
That's right. It's actually almost a sequel to the last play I did here called Freedom Rider, which was set in 1961. Yeah.
Is it, I assume, you cover the civil rights movement and the activities
it's another
that were
part
going
of the
on?
Civil rights movement. I think more than anything, it's a time where we were, as a nation, trying to figure out where we were going to go and how we were going to go. The Vietnam War was going on. The women's movement was beginning to kick in gear, the civil rights movement. So there were all of these movements. But the great thing about this era, number one, there was incredible music. That was number one. But number two, the music was a part of the spirit of people who believed that if we come together, we could do anything. Mm-hmm. We could change the world.
Yeah, there was a lot of spirit back.
It was great spirit.
It was very controversial times. Mm-hmm. Politics got involved, especially in Mississippi, where some unfortunate things happened.
From the point of segregation in America and the fact that the civil rights movement having really gotten its big boost in the early 60s, Mississippi was still left behind. And this play focuses on the efforts of young people, students from colleges across the country, black and white, who decided to give up their summer vacations to go south to Mississippi to help with the registration of voters.
You wrote this play, you co-wrote this play with two of your colleagues.
Yes, with Denise Nicholas, who some of you may know in your audience from Room 222, mm-hmm. one of the first black actresses to have a major role on TV. But she also co-starred with Carol O'Connor in The Heat of the Night, and she's done a bunch of other things. But most notably, she lived Freedom Summer. She was in a theater group called the Free Southern Theater in Mississippi, and they did theater as part of that movement. And the other person, Sibu Siso Mamba, is from Southern Africa. And he actually was here in Kansas City where we did a show together a few years back called Train to 2010, and that took place in South Africa. So we're working together.
Duncan McIntyre is in the show. Duncan has, as well as being in the MFA program, has some really impressive credits as well. Who do you play in this show?
In this show, I play Mickey Schwerner. Michael Schwerner is his actual name, but we call him Mickey. Everybody called him Mickey. He was a civil rights activist. He's from New York. He was a Jewish civil rights worker from New York. And he, along with James Chaney and Andrew Goodman, were actually prepping in Ohio with the students that were the students hadn't quite arrived yet, but they were in training to go down to Mississippi for the summer to open these freedom schools and encourage and teach about voting rights for African Americans in Mississippi. And when one of the churches that was supposed to be set up as a freedom school that Mickey had recruited and helped the elders convince them to open a freedom school gets firebombed. And so he and James Chaney and Andrew Goodman get in a car and go down to Mississippi, and they don't get found, which in an odd way kind of brings a lot of national attention to this movement that was already starting. Mm-hmm. And for Mickey and Andrew, you know, sadly, because they were white in that car, brought even more national attention to this movement, even though James, you know, was, as they were looking for these kids, when they go missing, they find countless young black men that have been killed, in, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm.
and never would have been found
had it not been for Mickey and Andrew in that car as well.
They had to have known they'd be in some kind of jeopardy, but yet they still went.
They still went. Yeah, Mickey. From all the research that we've done, and you know, Rick has been coming to our classes for 3 years. We've been working on this project since I've been in grad school. So I've got to live with this character for quite a while and live with this story. So all the research that we've done has led me to believe that Mickey was totally aware of that. Mm-hmm. And he dedicated his life to this. He and Rita, his mm-hmm. wife, were they knew that. They knew that going in. That was part of their whole what they knew they could bring to the movement. So
yeah. And I think that's also part of the whole movement.
Yeah.
The fact that they all knew, mm-hmm. whether you were going to Mississippi or whether you were marching down the streets arm in arm, you knew you were facing as much as life and death situations because of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. And I should say because of a lot of things that we're reminded of that are happening today. Where where these movements are faced with movements from the opposite side as well, just as passionately, and this whole dialogue that we're not having in a healthy way needs to be held, and that is one of the main reasons we're doing this play.
I'm curious about Denise. Did she tell you about any of the personal things that happened to her during that time?
Oh, yeah. She told us about how she stayed with Fannie Lou Hamer, who was one of the matriarchs of the SNCC movement. SNCC was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and she was a part of that. And she talked about how they would do plays like Waiting for Godot. And, and these people, they had never even gone to a play before, and they're sitting there wondering, what in the world? But one of the things that Fannie Lou Hamer, who is a hero of the civil rights movement in America, said after watching Waiting for Godot, it was total silence. And then she said, well, Fannie Lou Hamer got up and said, I guess we know a little bit about waiting.
Yes.
Right?
And I remember this.
Yeah. And so she told those stories. She also told the stories of the level of passion that existed between the men and women, the young men and women there. So I bring back the idea of the importance of music, because music was so much of what the 60s was about. And we have Motown in the show. We have Bob Dylan and Donovan in the show. We have Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions. So the people who remember those and lived those times are going to love this play and this music. But even the young people who did not live those times are going to, if we do our jobs right, create the connection between then and now, because they say if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. We have to go forward.
Well, and that, I think that's the great thing that Denise has brought into the room too, of like she talked about how young she was when this was going on, mm-hmm. and the inspiring things that we see that are happening today with the Parkland survivors and the youth that is bringing that movement, you know, that forward. And it is an odd parallel that we're seeing, and so it couldn't be a better time to put this play out there, you know, mm-hmm. about the connection with the youth.
And she I also, believe it's on purpose.
Oh yeah, absolutely. She also gave us a copy of her book, Freshwater Road. That was super beneficial, because it was, even though it's technically cloaked in fiction, I mean, we know she lived a lot of that. It was a great resource for us to understand what, you know, she went through in Mississippi.
And she was also on the cover of Jet Magazine.
That's right.
She was a well-known name.
Yes, and she's looking forward to being here.
She's
been here already for workshops, for rehearsals, and she is coming back for the show, the performances.
Yeah, ask her what happened to the kid with the red fuzzy hair on room 222. Whatever happened to him?
Well, you know what? I'm going to direct her to you.
You may do that. The show is called Freedom Summer. It runs May 4th through the 13th. Not every night, of course. What? Can you give me a rough thumbnail? What nights of the week do you expect to be working on that, Duncan? Do you know?
I think it's every night but Monday.
Every night but Monday because we are we're in the Spencer stage and the other two shows are in the Copagan. So I believe we run every night and then the other two run
in Rep. But we're also very happy to be part of Kansas City Rep's Festival of New Works and really honored to be part of something that our colleagues the other writers are doing at the Copacan.
You co-founded an organization called Crossroads Theater Company, and you won a Tony Award as Artistic Director for the best regional theater
company. Regional theater in 1999. That's
now,
correct.
That had to have been quite an honor.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful because I had been there for 20 years, and I was planning to leave after that, at least to take a sabbatical for a year. And I lived in Trinidad. For a while, I lived in South Africa, but to have gone knowing that we received this honor was special, not because it was an award, but because never in the history of the American theater had a theater of color, let alone a black theater, received this award. So it kind of showed the world that anybody could do it. We could do it if we focus on excellence, and that was always our first. We put an emphasis on the work of black writers and a focus on our culture and how it connects to other cultures. But first and foremost in our mission was artistic excellence. We had the opportunity to do that for those years and honored by that award.
Projects that you have in mind in the future? Would you like to share anything?
Well, there's supposed to be this is a trilogy. Freedom Rider is 1961, Letters from Freedom Summer is 1964, and probably the summer of 68 or the summer of 69.
I would have guessed 68.
You know, because, 68 and 69, the summer of love, the Woodstock that followed, and the Mets won the World Series for the first time. We put a man on the moon. But we also invaded Cambodia, so there was Kent State and a lot of uprisings. It was quite a time. And unfortunately, it was at 68 was when we lost Dr. King, and Bobby Kennedy, and just a lot. It was a tough time, the middle 60s, because of assassinations, and you wondered who was going to be next. Mm-hmm. And yet, the youth kept going. The youth kept going, the music kept going, and that was... That is an era that I'm really happy to be a part of, and we'll see what comes next. So that's that.
Now, Duncan's about to graduate from the MFA program, where Theodore Swets told me one time that on any given night, one of his graduates is on stage somewhere performing.
Well, we hope so. As a new graduate, I hope that's the case.
It's true.
It's pretty exciting. I mean, it's 3 years of work being culminated in. It's going to be interesting, but I got to go back to the real world now. So that's a whole other level of scary.
Hopefully, you'll be working as a graduate of this prestigious program, which is very difficult to get into. And Ricardo will be forever labeled as a Tony Award winner.
Okay.
So people like me who do these shows will always label you that way. So
thank you. Thank you. I'm also the first son of my mother and father.
That's right. Well, me too.
Me three.
Show is called Freedom Summer. It runs May 4th through the 13th at the Spencer Theater on the campus of UMKC, 4949 Cherry. The number to call for more information, 816-235-2700. That's the same number for the Rep and the things that they do, and some other theaters in town use that number as well. Or online at kcrep.org. UMKC may have it on their website
I'm sure.
As well. For Freedom Summer. which is going on, part of the New Works Festival and the KC Origins, you called it, as well, Duncan. Yeah.
And I also want to say that it features people from the community, including Danny Cox, a famous musician, and Mia Ramsey, who is an incredible gospel performer. So it's a whole host of people who will be on stage to greet you.
Is Danny playing music? Or
yes,
is he
and
acting?
Singing.
Or both?
All three.
All three?
He's acting. He's playing music and he's singing. He's the storyteller.
He does a lot of work with the Theater for Young America.
Yeah.
As well. Plays several roles over there. Well, thanks so much for being with us to tell us all about Freedom Summer and all that went into 1964. Could have also been about 1968. I guess maybe you'll have a play in the future that covers the time
we're
in
hoping
1968.
For that.
And Duncan, thank you so much for being with us as well. Ricardo Kahn. He's the director and co-author of Freedom Summer, and Duncan McIntyre, the secret courage at the Coterie, also been with Actors Theater, Richard III, at the Great River Shakespeare. Where is that at?
That's in Winona, Minnesota.
I guess I asked you that.
I
already asked you that.
Yes, I was there last summer.
Yes, so thank you very much for being with us, both of you.
Pleasure.
The Jazz Insider is coming up next. He's going to have some great jazz for you. KKFI is known, of course, for its jazz and its blues programming. Jazz from 1 to 3, the blues from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.